Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of September. Some of you may have seen the front page story in Isthmus magazine, and it's a really fascinating story about this project called Ice Cube. It's a $270 million telescope called Ice Cube. It promises to bring in focus some of the most violent and intriguing phenomena, the article says, in the universe. Ice Cube could bring a great leap forward in human understanding of the universe, and it also, as our guest says, represents a recent shift from looking into deep space using physical light to observing it by other means. As a result of a huge grant from the National Science Foundation and from German and Swedish partners in this project, there are people who descend on the South Pole from November to mid-February. Actually, they're there all year, but this is when a large number of people go there, and they are tracking neutrinos, and we will hear what those are. Mark Crossberg is our guest this hour, a physics researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who is working on Ice Cube and has been to Antarctica several times, I believe. He moved to Scotland when he was 6 years old, and he returned to the United States to Yale for college. He got his doctorate from the University of Michigan in high energy physics and then became a researcher on Ice Cube for the University of Wisconsin. He said he actually wanted to move out of the Midwest to better weather, but he's glad he took the job in Madison so he can have better weather in Antarctica. He will talk to us about what he's been working on in the massive nature of this project and what they'll be getting to from their research. And we'll welcome phone calls, as we always do, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hello, Mark. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi. Actually, UW-Madison has a pretty strong presence in Antarctica, and they have for a number of years, haven't they?
Yes. They've done a lot of drilling in the past, a lot of coring. Before I joined the experiment, there was a lot of activity going on, and there's activity going on now. I think in that article that you mentioned in the Isthmus, there were some interviews with a professor in the university who does a lot of research there.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what the – let me move your mic just a second so it's closer. Here, hold on. There we go. Tell me what the Ice Cube project is.
So Ice Cube is basically – it's a telescope. It's a telescope – not using physical light, but using a particle called a neutrino. And it's basically this giant big thing that we're putting down deep under the ice. We're actually drilling. I don't think I knew this when I joined the experiment. Actually, maybe I did, but I don't think I really did. But the South Pole is where this telescope is located, is basically 2 miles of ice.
You know, 90, wow.
95% of the world's ice is in Antarctica. And so we actually drill 1.5 miles down using a hot water drill. Down deep down, you know, down we get to about 300 meters from the bedrock, and we actually do this because we're putting in these light sensitive detectors, little basketball sized spheres that we call digital optical modules, and we're putting thousands of them down into the ice, into this big huge three dimensional grid that's about a 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer, and that's why we call it Ice Cube. And that's basically going to be the telescope. It's actually it's not your normal telescope.
I guess not.
Right.
And why would you put a telescope down into the ice?
We use a property of physics. We use something called we're looking for something called a type of light called Cherenkov radiation. It's kind of a blue light. If anyone's ever seen, not very many people have, but if anyone's ever seen pictures of the cooling water outside of a nuclear reactor, it kind of glows a very pretty blue.
Huh.
And that's actually the color light we're looking for. And so what actually happens is these particles that we're interested in, they end up interacting with the Earth. And at the end of the day, you get a particle going through our telescope giving off this blue light.
Hmm.
And our sensors are they're called photomultiplier tubes. They're inverse light bulbs. So instead of emitting light, they actually collect the light and they turn that into charge, electricity, and we actually see the light going through our detector. And these sensors are accurate to about 5 billionths of a second. And it's basically this three-dimensional grid where they get the sensors get hit at slightly different times. And then you use a computer algorithm to reconstruct path the particle took as it went through the telescope, as it went through the ice. And the reason we actually are in Antarctica doing this is because the ice, a mile and a half down, is incredibly clear. Okay, we have these little little flasher LEDs on our modules, and we put light into the ice, and it's very dim light, and it'll go easily 2,000 feet through the ice, and our module's 2,000 feet away. You'll see this tiny little faint flash of light from, you know, really far away. And so the ice is super clear, much clearer than you know, you can actually, it's because of the high pressure. It's because it's, you know, huge pressures are at work here. All the air bubbles are gone way down deep under the ice, and the light just travels really, really far. And so that's basically why we're in Antarctica, why we're putting the telescope there, why we're putting these sensors down under the ice. There's another experiment that is trying to do it in the deep down in the Mediterranean.
Really?
We actually think there's reasons to do it in one place and not the other. We actually like where we are. We're putting our telescope because it's basically this super clear ice that the light will go really, really far, and we don't have to deal with water that kind of can mess with electronics and stuff. So, but having said that, it's actually a really hard place to actually work. And as you said, we can only actually go there between November and February. Otherwise, it's too cold to fly there.
Oh, really? That's the reason for that.
Yeah.
How do you get a mile and a half is a long distance. How do you drill down that far?
Right. So we have a high-tech hot water drill that we've developed. We have a whole huge team of people that work on that. Actually, most of the people who go down to Antarctica are working on the drilling side of things, because that's actually a very labor-intensive, huge amount of work. It's a hot water drill, and we use, I think, something like 2,000 gallons of fuel. Actually, it's more like 4,000. 2,000 to 4,000 gallons of fuel to actually power the drill, to drill this hole that's about the size, you know, a little bit bigger than a basketball. That's the size of the module that we're trying to put down into it. And it basically goes down a mile and a half. One of the things I actually like when I talk to kids is I say, have you ever seen the 8 to 10 year old kids? And I don't know if I should be asking this, but I like to say, have you ever seen the movie Alien versus Predator? And about half the kids will say, oh, that they really like telling me that they've seen the movie if they've seen it. And the reason I ask is because in the movie they have a slightly larger hole in the movie in Antarctica, and in the movie it took them a week to make it, right? And we actually our drillers can make this hole in about 24 hours. So I like to say we beat science fiction in that case. anyway, so the resources, the whole thing at the South Pole is it's very hard to have the resources and all the supplies you need, right? And so we use, you know, as I said, several thousand gallons of fuel to actually drill a hole. And the thing that happens is every year when the airfield opens up at the South Pole, because basically about the only way to get there is through the U.S. military. The Air National Guard flies these C-130 Hercules to the South Pole, and every time they fly there, they drop off, they empty the excess fuel out of the wings in the fuel tanks, and so they'll drop off a few thousand gallons of fuel every time they go there, and that powers the station. It powers all the work that's going on, and it also powers the people who stay, the, you know, heat for the people who work there and live there throughout the whole year. And so they'll drop off a few hundred thousand gallons of fuel, I think, during the season, which is, again, November to February. And then that lasts until the station opens up again the following November, end of October.
Tell me more about these neutrinos. Who decided that you were going to, first of all, when were they discovered? Who decided that they were a key to the larger universe? And what do you hope, and maybe you're going to find things you didn't even know you're going to find, but what are you looking for? What are they going to tell you about life?
Right. So the thing I like to say is every time people have built a telescope looking in, say, a new energy range or a new type of light, or they've discovered something about the universe that they never imagined, never even thought of. And so when you look at the human body, you can look at it, you know, you can take a picture of it. You could look at it with X-rays. You can look at it with, say, infrared. And every time you do this, you learn something that you learn something new. Maybe you learn something that you didn't know was there. And then you can do the same thing with the universe. And so, you know, there's visible light telescopes, there's infrared telescopes, there's gamma ray telescopes, you know, X-rays, radio telescopes. And what we're doing is we're looking in a higher energy range, and we're not actually using light this time, but we're using a particle called a neutrino. Basically, using neutrinos enables us to look at the universe in a kind of an energy range, a higher energy range that no one's ever really looked at it before. This telescope is basically one of the main reasons to build is it's a telescope of discovery. We're hoping to discover something that no one ever thought of, right? People also know that there are very high energy particles out there, and there are high energy cosmic rays that hit the Earth, and there's cosmic ray telescopes and muon stuff on the surface of the Earth, and they can see these incredibly high energy particles. But when you see a high-energy cosmic ray, they're charged, and they actually don't go through the universe in a straight line. Okay, so when you actually see these really high-energy events, you don't know where they came from. You just know they're out there. Neutrinos are not charged. They actually travel in a straight line through the universe. And our telescope will actually be able to tell the direction that they came from. So we actually get how energetic they were and the direction. And as these things go through our telescope, we can actually then backtrack them back to their source. So we're basically looking in the sky for a source of these things, and people basically think they're out there, and we hope to actually be able to say, maybe they came from that star right up there. Hmm. No one knows where these things come from.
And what purpose do they serve?
Well, neutrinos are a fairly famous particle. They're incredibly light. They're chargeless. You have actually 10 million neutrinos going through your thumb every second.
No,
really? Yeah. They most of matter is empty space. Neutrinos don't. One reason our telescope is so big is because they're so hard to actually see. Okay, in order to see these things, these high energy neutrinos, you've got to actually build a really big telescope. You've got to instrument a very large volume of ice, and that's why we're actually instrumenting a cubic kilometer of ice, right? They're incredibly hard. They're incredibly hard to detect, and we're employing a trick. We actually don't actually see the neutrino directly. We see the byproduct of when the neutrino hits a particle of ice or rock. And then it creates another particle that's traveling in the same direction that is charged, and then that emits light, and then our telescope sees it. Huh. And the amount of energy, and basically the particle that it converts into, which is called a muon, it has the same energy basically that the neutrino had, and it's going along the same direction the neutrino was traveling in, and so we actually see that, and we know then that. Just before that, there was a neutrino there traveling along that same direction, and so we're looking for an excess of neutrinos in the sky, and so basically we make a sky map, and the one thing that's kind of neat about the telescope is we actually basically see these neutrinos in one direction. Okay, there's stuff hitting our telescope from all directions. Cosmic rays coming from above, coming from like the atmosphere above us, above the South Pole, there's an awful lot of them. And cosmic rays are a lot of them are muons, and they're like heavy electrons. And they will actually travel tens of kilometers through the Earth sometimes before they're stopped. Our telescope sees a huge number of these particles coming from the surface. Okay? And then we see a very small number of neutrinos coming from all directions. We can't really tell the neutrinos, for the most part. We can't really tell them apart from these muons. But we can tell the direction. So there's this huge number of particles coming from above, these muons, but they aren't coming from below, right? And our telescope, what we're mainly interested in is particles, neutrinos, but these particles coming from below us. Our telescope actually looks down. Our photomultiplier tubes are pointed down. We're actually looking into the Earth. And we use the Earth as a filter to filter out all of these excess cosmic ray muon stuff. Neutrinos, that where you have 10 million going through your thumb every second, they'll pass right through the Earth. Okay, and occasionally they'll hit something in the Earth, convert into a muon, and continue on their way out. And when we see particles coming from below us, we know that the only way that actually could have happened is if a neutrino had gone most of the way through the Earth, hit something, convert it into one of these particles that we're interested in, and then we see the light from it. And so our telescope actually looks down. So I think there was a funny article, I think, in Scientific American many years ago. They had the seven wonders of modern astronomy, and they gave a nickname to each telescope. And the Hubble was called the sharpest, I think. And the predecessor for Ice Cube was actually a detector called Amanda that's kind of been absorbed by Ice Cube, and its nickname was the weirdest.
It's really such an elaborate thing, isn't it? I mean, when I think about the people who have to tend to it and what it takes to get there, and I hope you discover something that nobody ever knew, because it's a lot of trouble to do it.
We hope so. That's what we're hoping for.
And when you think about that, that something, what do you think that something might be?
Well, that's a good question. No, I don't think it's this thing where no one could have predicted it. So it could be anything. We saw a year ago. We deploy these sensors and we start. Our telescope is running now, right? It's just getting bigger every year. We're drilling more holes and deploying more sensors, and we started deploying these things 4 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and we've got like two more years mm-hmm. of work. So we've actually completed like about 2/3 or 3/4 of the telescope. And a couple months after we deploy the sensors, so we're actually going to drill a total of approximately 80 holes in the ice, and each hole is getting about 60 sensors. Okay, and so we're putting in about 5,000 of these digital optical modules down under the ice. And every year, we actually then, a couple months after we deploy the sensors, we actually start taking data with them. And so every year, the telescope gets bigger and bigger. So last year, we put in like 19 holes, and the telescope got about 50% bigger than the year before. And the year before, we put in like 18 holes, and the telescope doubled in size. And so we're analyzing the data, and we're looking for, say, these an excess of high-energy neutrinos coming from somewhere in the sky, which we're actually, as I said, we're primarily looking down, so we're actually looking in the northern hemisphere. We're not really as sensitive looking down into the southern, down towards Australia or something, right? We're looking for an excess, and a year ago we saw a hint of an excess, but it was statistically, it wasn't significant, and then as we took more data, it went away, right? It would have been fun if it had actually been enhanced with more data, right? That one was actually kind of interesting, I thought, because the excess was in a part of the sky where there was really nothing there that would have caused it. But anyway, it went away with more data.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Mark Crossberg is our guest, physics researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's been working for a few years on the Ice Cube project, an ultra-high-energy neutrino telescope being built about to through its done at the South Pole. So we'll be with you in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, we also have an email address you can use, which is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Mark, and let's start with Paul from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
I love good science on a Monday morning.
Good.
Hey, my question for the guest is, I'm here in Duluth, and I remember hearing, I guess, about a year or two ago, that there was a project to put neutrino detectors in a deep mine up on the Iron Range. And the comment the guest made about the, ice versus rock, first of all, do you know about this project in northern Minnesota? Are you connected with it in any way? And I guess that's all I was wondering about. Just what the, if there's any connection or what if it turns out all the neutrinos are coming from one direction?
Okay, so I think I know about this experiment. There's an ongoing effort to put some neutrino detectors in, I think, mines in South Dakota. Maybe that you're talking about another one. But those are different types of neutrino detectors. You can have lower energy neutrinos that people are very interested in as well, and for other reasons. And you don't need to have this huge three-dimensional grid to actually detect them. So there's famous neutrino detectors all over the world that are deep underground in big tanks of liquid and they primarily are looking at, say, lower energy events. Now you say if all the neutrinos are coming from one spot, well, that'd be very interesting. I mean, nobody knows where these things come from, and that's what we're trying to find out. Nobody knows, and that's what we're looking for.
So no, but there are no ideas about it from what.
Well, I don't think anyone. I don't think anyone would believe that if there was. If we found one source, I don't think anyone would believe that that was the only one.
But when
we find a source, I'm sure we will be publicizing it.
I'm sure you will. Thanks, Paul, for the call. Laura is next from New Berlin. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Mark. I'm just wondering if Mark thinks that the human search for discovery is worth any cost. I'm wondering specifically if he might assess what kind of damages occur, let's say, from this human presence in Antarctica, you mentioning burning hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil just to be there. Is this quest, which has always been exalted for knowledge, always worth any cost that may stem from it?
No, I'd say it's not. But however, in this case, Antarctica is a kind of a neat place because many years ago, I'm not sure of the year, the world got together, and there's something called the Antarctic Treaty, and the Antarctica was ruled a continent only for science. Nobody can go there to do commercial stuff. Nobody can go there for industrial purposes or mining or anything. It's only for science, and so nobody can do anything there scientific without basically the agreement from the other countries who have signed this treaty. No one's allowed to go there and say, "Hey, I want to go," and we had to get permission. We had to file, I think a way to think about this is the world gets together and says, "This is a good idea. This is worth doing," and go ahead and do it. And so that's how Antarctica works. Other places, of course, aren't. There's no such. I mean, if someone wanted to do an experiment in some other country, there's nothing like this. In this case, it's actually a much more interesting situation because you've got this worldwide governing body that basically decides whether or not it's worthwhile. And right. Yeah.
Thank you very much for the call. Tell me about because it is quite a story. Arduous a journey it is to get there. What do you go through? How do you get there?
So when we go there, it's actually kind of neat because you've got different countries have bases all over Antarctica, and so to get there, there's a whole group of people who'll go through Chile, southern part of South America. There's a whole some countries will go through South Africa, southern part of Africa, South Africa. The United States Antarctic Program goes through New Zealand, and so we actually have to fly. We have to get to Christchurch, which is a long trip, right? It's like a 12-hour flight from L.A. to Auckland or Sydney and then another flight to Christchurch. And New Zealand is a really nice place. I definitely like it quite a lot. And so then once we get to New Zealand, we go to a warehouse that we check out a whole bunch of clothes for the trip because it's really cold there. In the summertime when I go, it's not that different from a cold Wisconsin winter night, right? But right now, the people who are there right now, they're experiencing close to minus 100 Fahrenheit.
Oh my gosh!
Close to minus 150 Fahrenheit with the wind, the wind chill.
Ugh.
Right? And I cannot imagine that. I mean, people say like when I go there, it's like minus 40 Fahrenheit or something, and maybe minus 60 with the wind. And then, you know, people say, well, minus, you know, if it goes to minus 50, it's my, well, what's the difference? Minus 40, minus 40. I can tell you that every time it gets 10 degrees colder, you feel it. It doesn't matter how cold it is. So I don't know. The people who are there experiencing minus 100, that's got to be tough. But they give us all these clothes to wear in Antarctica at Christchurch. And then we start flying U.S. military planes.
Huh.
The U.S. military flies us from Christchurch to Antarctica, to the coast, a big base called McMurdo that has, you know, over 1,000 people working there. They do a whole bunch of research all over the continent. And so we fly to the coast. And then we fly on a three-hour flight on a C-130 Hercules that's actually got skis on it because the runway is an ice runway. It's operated by the New York Air National Guard. And they basically fly us up to the plateau, and it's about a three-hour flight to the center of Antarctica.
Goodness.
And we land on an ice runway. And there's this station there. They do a whole bunch of science, right? There's lots and lots of, you know, climate studies. We've got there's different types of telescopes there. A lot of research is going on there. And our project is one of the bigger ones right now at the station because of the whole construction aspect of the project. We'll send approximately 100 people to the South Pole to work in the 3.5 months that the station's open. And a lot of them are coming from Wisconsin, but as well as our partners in the other universities and other countries.
And where do you live?
In Antarctica?
Yeah.
In the South Pole? So they have some tents, heated tents that people stay in. And then when you get more ice time, so there'll be 50 to 100 people living in the heated tents. And about a year or two ago, they christened a new station. The U.S. Antarctic Program built a new station that'll actually hold about 150 people. And those are – it's nice. It's a little nicer to stay in inside where you've got –
I would think so.
You don't have to actually walk outside to go to the bathroom. There's a bathroom inside the building, which is nice. And so there's about 150 people that stay in there. So you'll have about 250 people there during the Antarctic summer. And then at the middle of February, when it gets close to minus 50 centigrade, which is the cutoff for when the C-130s can fly to the South Pole, as it's getting colder, then almost everybody leaves. And right now there's about 40 people at the South Pole. And they're trapped, right? And there's these famous stories, say, where people get sick and they can't leave. They're trapped from February until November. There's basically no way out. And they live there, and they maintain. You know, we have two people working for us who maintain our computers and our experiment and keep things running. And of the 40 who are there,
and they can do this. They're not claustrophobic or
no. I wouldn't want to do this, but they applied for the job, and the people who are there now, they love it. They're not even eager to leave. They
really?
Said they actually right now are going to stay about 2 weeks longer than we'd require them to stay. That's the plan. They're actually saying they have a great time. So why would you want to actually do that? It's a neat thing to it's a neat thing to do. I wouldn't want to do it for so long. I think one of the things that I would be if I was to do it, it would probably be because during so you have right now it's a constant night, right? In South Pole you have one long night that lasts like 4 months. A sunrise that lasts, you know, a month or two, then one long day that lasts about 4 months, and then a sunset. It's basically one day, one night in South Pole because of the way the Earth's rotation works. And during the winter, you know, in the middle of winter, you see auroras off sometimes every night. They're spectacular. I've seen pictures of these things, and they're amazing, right? And so the people who are there now, the winter rovers, most the people that work for us and most of the winter rovers, they love actually going outside, even if it's like minus 80, minus – they love going outside and looking at the stars. It's pitch black. You get probably the best view of the stars you probably can ever get, and you see these fantastic auroras like many times a week.
It must be wonderful. And what about the physical beauty of the place? I hear, and it's hard to imagine for those of us who, you know, can't imagine being that kind of cold, that it's a whole different kind of terrible beauty, I think, is how you've described it or others have.
So Antarctica is incredibly beautiful. And I think the coast of Antarctica, what I've seen of it, is amazing. South Pole is more like a desert. It's basically a plateau of ice. as far as you can see. It's basically a flat plateau of ice. And it is really neat, but it is a little bit like a wasteland. I actually think one of the neat things when I'm there in the summertime is, I don't know if any of the, I mean, I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen sun dogs. And so you see these, if you look at the sun, sometimes you'll see like a kind of a faint sun, 30 degrees to the right of the sun and 30 degrees to the left. Well, in Antarctica, there are so many ice crystals in the air sometimes that you see, that it turns out there's this huge halo effect, where you get rings around the sun and rainbows around the sun and inverted rainbows around the sun just caused by all the ice crystals in the air. And that's actually when I feel like I'm not on the planet Earth. When I'm walking, I see this about every two or three weeks I'm there. I'm walking along the ice, and there's enough ice crystals in the air where the view of the sun and these rainbows around it is just amazing.
Oh, my. I would imagine. Let's go to another phone call. Chris is our next caller from Butler. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I have three brief questions. Are all neutrino detectors worldwide pointing downward? Why do we call this neutrino detector a telescope and not an observatory? And can you tell us about the 1987 event when a star went nova, and maybe that was or wasn't picked up as some sort of statistical rise at the neutrino detectors?
Let's see. Let me see if I can remember. So I'll answer the last question about supernova 1987A. So for Ice Cube, we're sensitive to supernovas. Now, it turns out that we're sensitive to supernovas, say, within our galaxy. We figure we're sensitive to maybe one every 30 years. So we're hoping for a supernova. It could happen at any moment. Okay, and the last big supernova was 1987. And that actually did set off multiple neutrino telescopes around the world saw neutrinos that came from this exploding star. Now, these neutrinos are actually low-energy neutrinos. A supernova is a different type of event than, say, what our telescope's primarily looking for. But when a star explodes and all these neutrinos are given off, there are so many of them. It's just incredible, the numbers of neutrinos that are given off, that you've got a neutrino telescope in the ice, or a neutrino telescope in a mine, a neutrino detector in a mine, or anywhere in the world. Often you can pick up the flux of neutrinos that are coming through your detector. Hmm. So that's one aspect. We're hoping to see a supernova. We actually probably wouldn't be able to tell you the direction it came from. We'd just say, hey, something major just happened, and it would be correlated with someone seeing, you know, an exploding star in the sky, right? So we'd be able to see it. So there were experiments that saw it. Now let's see, what were the other questions? There was one on
why it is that it's downward, or are all
No. So as I said, for low energy stuff, as I said, we're looking for high energy neutrinos where there's a track and we point it back to the stars. But for something like, say, some of this low energy stuff like supernova, it's really hard to figure out the direction that the stuff's coming from. You just see like a large flux of particles. So some of these experiments in other parts of the world, I don't think they care too much. I think they don't care too much about the direction. So they're not necessarily looking in a particular direction. They're just looking for neutrinos.
I see.
And then he had one other question.
What was the other one, Chris?
Do we call these things, as far as all the neutrino detectors, do we call them a telescope or an observatory? Why one word and not the other?
You know, that's... I think people have talked about this within my own experiment, and I think we decided we preferred on the word telescope. I hope. I'm pretty sure we like the word telescope, but we've talked about observatory and telescope, and we settled on telescope. Now, I think there's not much between them at some level, but yeah.
You know, it seems to me that if a star goes nova and then we pick up a rise in neutrinos worldwide, that there really is a direction, that the neutrinos left the star and came here no faster than the speed of light. I'm making a connection here, and maybe I've got a misconception, but don't we say, look, the star just went nova, that's at position A, here's the Earth at position B. The neutrinos, at least the ones that we've noticed, have moved between point A and point B. In that sense, am I correct that we have the direction down?
Yes, so you'd have to correlate the times of the events, I think, with the different telescopes around the world. So Ice Cube is part of something called the supernova, SNews, and it's basically there's several detectors around the world that if they think we saw a supernova, if any of them thinks they saw a supernova, they immediately alert, like, say, some centralized body. And so there are several neutrino detectors around the world that actually will immediately send a signal to this, like, overall controller that will actually say, you know, and then if they get multiple ones coming in at the same time, then they, you know, they start saying, okay, there's something going on. I suspect you're right that there might, it might be possible with detectors on different sides of the planet, you might be able to figure out partial direction. But I think I'm pretty sure any supernova that was seen by detectors in the Earth, astronomers would see the light that results from the supernova. Because basically this thing just, it explodes. The star explodes and gives off a whole bunch of light and a whole bunch of neutrinos and yeah.
Anything else, Chris?
You know, by the way, what this does is it demolishes the idea that astronomy is something that you can't put in a bottle. It demolishes the idea that astronomy is about distant stuff that you really can't touch. And a psychology professor once sternly lectured me incorrectly that astronomy is never anything you can get your hands on. Well, the nova and neutrino connection demolishes that, and I'm pleased that the guest has corrected the person who lectured me in the past who happened to be wrong.
Thank you very much for the call. How did you find this project? I mean, isn't it, do you ever stop and think, oh, look what I'm doing with my life?
I was lucky. I actually, I was a grad student at the University of Michigan, and I shared an office with a friend of mine, and he actually ended up working on this experiment.
Uh-huh.
And then, I don't know, 3 years later, I graduated, and I just emailed a couple of friends saying, "Hey, I just graduated." And then he said, "Oh, you should try and get a job on Ice Cube." And I said, "Well, you know, it's in Wisconsin. I've lived in Michigan for a while. I think I'd like to go to better weather." And then I ended up coming out and seeing the place, and I ended up working here, and I'm really glad I did.
Hmm. Here's an email that's come in. Can you talk about searches for neutrinos in the old salt mines near Lake Erie, which took place many years ago?
Probably not. Not too much. I think I wouldn't want to.
Okay. Let's welcome more phone calls, and here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. Mark Crossberg is our guest. He's a physics researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is working on the project we've been talking about this hour, Ice Cube, an ultra-high energy neutrino telescope that's being built, about two-thirds completed now at the South Pole. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mark Crossberg is our guest. And while I'm thinking of it, I have some pictures. I'm not sure where these came from that look at, you know, stations that are in operation at the South Pole. Do you have how is the information being transmitted from those that are already working? Is it via computer somehow, or how do you get what the images? Let me get your mic on. There.
Well, of course, everyone brings back pictures when they travel there. We actually, for our, the research at the South Pole in Antarctica, we have access, or the National Science Foundation has access to a satellite where we transfer data. So we actually transfer, for several hours a day, we actually have access to some satellites called GOES and TDRS. And so our experiment transfers 50 gigabytes of data every day over the satellite. But as far as pictures go, like Ice Cube has, there's icecube.wisc.edu, and there are links there that you can see photographs of the project and, you know, Antarctica, and there's a lot of neat pictures there.
Yeah, it's quite a place. I would think just getting there make you feel like you're on another planet.
Yes.
It's so hard to do it. We go next to Jordan from Amherst. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was hoping you could tell me a little bit. I watch a lot of programs about the universe and this and that, and I hear a lot about neutrinos, and I was wondering if we know what they're made out of, if they have a charge. I know they don't interact with matter very well. Do they know anything about that, or is that what the ice cube is for?
So neutrinos are chargeless, almost massless. As I said, I think I saw something where I work where it said something like so many hundreds of trillions of neutrinos pass through the Earth every second. I mean, as I said, you got like 10 million going through your thumb every second. And the high energy neutrinos that we're looking for, I think we think they're passing through your body all the time. Not at the levels of 10 million through your thumb, because most of those are low energy neutrinos that we're not interested in. But the high energy ones, they're passing through your body all the time, and we think like in our entire lives, maybe one will actually hit us. Well, like one will actually interact, and it's not like it matters. It just like hits an electron in your body or something, and it's not like it's a big deal. But our telescope, as I said, we're looking down. We're looking for these high energy neutrinos. We see a handful of neutrinos every hour coming from below. We see something like, I don't know, four per hour. And we're basically building up a sky map of where these things are coming from. Okay? And some of that, a lot of that is background, and then some of that is signal. And that's like another little thing that I'd have to explain that maybe I don't want to get into. But it turns out, so we're looking for an excess. So we're basically seeing like four neutrinos per hour coming from below. We're building up a sky map, and then we're looking for like an excess in that say photograph of the universe.
All right. Are they like low mass or no mass particles?
Neutrinos are very low mass. People used to think that they had no mass, but they actually have a very, very small mass. So they're very, very, very light.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. We just want to alert you that coming up at 11 this morning, President Obama is delivering a speech in New York on the first anniversary of the Lehman Brothers collapse. He'll be talking about proposed changes to prevent a future crisis like the one that sent the global economy into a tailspin. The speech will be on our website this morning, WPR.org. We've just found this out and want to let you know, WPR.org. Click to the president's speech on our homepage, and it's again at 11 o'clock today. Ron is next from Fond du Lac. Hi, Ron.
Hi, yeah. I remember back when I was young, 57, 58, and 59, my father worked as a machinist in the Newman's lab at Cornell. And at that time, Hans Bethe was putting together three trailers and moving them over to Colorado for detecting high-energy particles. And was Hans Bethe one of the originals in terms of high-energy particles? And be interested and see how this mushroom from maybe where he started to where you are today, especially in terms of you know, the particle physics because of wavelength and so on like that, how separate, okay, your sensors are and how that would look in the atmosphere. I'll listen to you off the air.
All right, Ron, thanks for your call.
I think I don't know the answer. I'd have to probably look something up. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. There's an international scope to this project as well. Am I right? You're working with people from Sweden, people from Germany. Are they all part of the Ice Cube project?
Yes. So we have hundreds of people working on the project. There's something like, I don't know, close to 30 institutions, I think.
Oh, my.
And some of them are in the U.S. Wisconsin actually is the primary investigator is Dr. Francis Halzen, and he basically is, you know, he got the proposal passed through the National Science Foundation to actually do this. And so the grant is something like $240 million from the National Science Foundation, and then approximately $35 million have come from Europe. Hmm. And so there's institutions in Germany, several institutions in Germany, Belgium, Holland, Sweden. The Germans and Swedes are fairly major collaborators. They've put in a lot of money. And then there's also institutions in, you know, New Zealand, England. They're all over the world.
That's nice. So it's a worldwide community in this place that's in the middle of nowhere.
That's right. Right.
Well, how many times have you been there?
I've been there five times.
Oh, my gosh.
Each of the last 5 years for about 5 weeks each time.
Wow.
It's really neat. It's really neat to go down, and I'm looking forward. I'm going back again in December for another, I guess, month or so.
Hmm. Let's go. Do you do the same thing every time that you're there or not?
Pretty much. Yeah, it's pretty similar. Each year is pretty similar because we're basically just making the telescope bigger. So I help on. I'm not one of the drillers I'm kind of like looking at the modules after they've been deployed, mainly trying to make sure they work. But it's close to a routine now. I think things seem to go pretty smoothly. At the beginning, it was much more hectic, I think, than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And we have like two more years worth of drilling and deploying, and then that's supposed to be the completed telescope.
Hmm. Let's go to Javier from Wausau. Hi, Javier.
Hi, hello. I'm wondering about the useful life of the telescope and how will you remove it after, and if there are any links that we can look at the work as it progresses. And I'll pick my comment up here. Thank you.
So the telescope is designed to run for 15 to 20 years. So all of the electronics was built with that in mind. And of course, if it's producing useful data, it's not like they're going to turn it off. Every few years we find something really neat, I'm sure that, you know, all of the neat stuff just keep, you know, they keep it running, right? So our stuff was designed to work for 15 to 20 years, and we actually do some studies to try to figure out, because we put these sensors in the ice, and if they do break down, we can't fix them. And you asked, like, you know, how do we get them out? We don't. They're in there. These things are down in the ice. There's basically no way to get them out. Hmm. And the ice sheet in Antarctica is moving at about 10 meters a year. So basically our telescope is actually moving 10 meters a year sideways across Antarctica. So I think they say, like, maybe in 30,000 years it'll fall into the ocean. I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
You got these sensors. What was I saying? I forget what he
wants you to reiterate the places where you can get pictures of what's going on.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Right. So there's links to the photographs of our experiment on icecube.wisc.edu.
Icecube.wisc.edu.
Yeah.
Okay. Todd is next from Madison. Hi, Todd.
Good morning. Yeah, more particle physics. I was wondering about what the theoretical or suggested sources of these high-energy neutrinos. Are we talking about Big Bang background radiation or events around black holes, or what sort of thing is it? Can you say anything?
So the high-energy neutrinos we're looking for would probably be associated with some of the most violent explosions in the universe.
Hmm.
There's some very violent stuff called gamma ray bursts out there, and you know, some people on the experiment think if we see a source, they're going to be associated with some of these stars that we know are putting out incredibly high energy particles to begin with. Supernova is something slightly different, where a star explodes and if it explodes not too far away from us, like we'll see that, but that's not the high energy neutrinos. That's just something else. So there's gamma. There's all kinds of different science that goes on looking, you know, associated with, you know, what if the neutrinos are associated with this type of star, or, you know, this type of thing. And at the end of the day, you know, we'll actually hopefully, you know, find us, you know, eventually we'll find a source and then point it back. And then, you know, people will say, oh, okay, these high energy. So right now, no one, I think it's fair to say that no one really has a really good model for these high energy neutrinos we're looking for are such high energy that no one really has a good model for how a particle with that amount of energy could be created in the first place. So mm-hmm. no one really knows what type, where they're getting made, you know, black holes, gamma, you know, no one really knows. And so we're hoping, you know, we'll find a source and look up and we'll point, it'll point back in the sky and people say, okay, they're coming from right up there and there's a, you know, there's a famous gamma ray star like right there. And okay, so they're making them, but no, nobody knows.
Thank you, Mark, so much for being with us. It was fascinating. Mark Crossberg, our guest, and we also want to let you know you can go to our website because we're going to link to Mark's website, too, so you can see pictures of all that they are doing. He is a researcher, physics researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison working on Ice Cube. So thanks to him, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 on the ID. Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.